A new nuclear arms race has started. Ending it will not be so easy.
There are more drivers on the nuclear highway, and there are much fewer traffic lights.
I'm Carolyn Beeler. How China is playing catch-up with the U.S. and Russia by expanding its nuclear forces. Also today, what it was like being the youngest elected leader in the world. An interview with Finland's former Prime Minister, Sanna Marin.
There was this moral panic. How can I spend this kind of free time with my friends as a prime minister? Is that appropriate?
And the sport has been around for a while, but you may not have heard of it.
The best way to describe it is like a mix between soccer and basketball.
We've got all those stories and more today on The World. This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. Happy Friday, and thank you for being here. This year's UN Climate Summit is being held in the Brazilian Amazon, putting a focus on the link between deforestation, agriculture, and carbon emissions. Agriculture is a major driver of climate change, and we wanted to hear how it is being talked about at COP30. So we reached out to Kaveh Zahidi, the climate director at the Food and Agriculture Organization of the United Nations. He joined us from COP30 in Belém, Brazil, and defined the problem for us.
When we talk about agriculture at FAO, we talk about the entirety, agriculture, aquaculture, livestock, forestry. It's all included. And it's around a third of greenhouse gas emissions come from the agriculture sector.
Those emissions come from what, deforestation to plant crops and allow grazing land, fertilizer use, what else?
Actually, increasingly, it's forest fires. Unbelievably, last year, about 127 million hectares of forests burned. We're talking about land about the size of Mexico. So that's becoming a considerable part of the emissions.
And that is included here because it's thought of as agriculture and land use change, this whole
stat.
Exactly.
But also, if you're looking at greenhouse gas emissions from production of food, the highest methane emissions come from rice production, from livestock. So we have emissions from across agriculture and food systems. And what we found actually this year with our numbers, it looks like slowly the on-farm emissions, there's a sort of decoupling between production and emission. But there's major concern in terms of pre- and post-production. That's where the emission increase seems to be.
Interesting. Can you tell me more about that?
Pre and post, it means that we have to look at the entire value chain, right? Whether it's the inputs that go into farming, including fertilizers, or the transport of agriculture, or indeed the whole processing and packaging, and all of that has emissions linked to it. And all of that has opportunities for reducing emissions linked to it.
So obviously the world and all its people, we still need to eat. Is it clear how much of these emissions could realistically be cut?
I don't know whether we can give you one single number of how much it could be cut, but we know that crop by crop, there's massive opportunities, right? We know, for example, that if you move from the traditional paddy rice to the wet dry method of producing rice, you're going to reduce emissions. But in addition to that, you reduce your reliance on water, which is becoming a much scarcer commodity. So I think sector by sector, there are ways of improving.
Mm.
So here in Brazil, and at this COP, one of the big discussions is about the power of restoration of degraded lands. About a third to a fifth of global agricultural land is degraded.
So by degraded, you mean basically used up and unsuitable for agriculture any longer, and
exactly,
bringing that back up to be able to be used so that other land doesn't have to be deforested?
Exactly right. And if we bring that land back into production, you have an enormous increase in your capacity to produce, of course, but also in doing so, and if you do it in the right way, you can build resilience, you can increase soil carbon and therefore reduce emissions. So it's like a single shot with multiple benefits. And that's they have some big programs in Brazil that are doing just that.
I'm speaking with Kaveh Zahidi, the climate director at the Food and Agriculture Organization. He is at the COP30 summit in Belém, Brazil. Kaveh, one of the major topics at this COP has been whether countries are going to agree to some sort of roadmap to phase out or down the use of fossil fuels. Agriculture is not a specific negotiating point. Are there things being negotiated that have to do with agricultural emissions?
I would say everything that's being negotiated has to do with agriculture and food systems. How can you, for example, in the conversation on just transition, how can you talk about a just transition that doesn't include agricultural workers and communities. How can you talk about loss and damage when you know that the majority of losses and damages are going on in agriculture and food systems? How can you talk about finance when you know that the finance is not flowing to the agri-food system solutions that are absolutely central to delivering both on adaptation and mitigation? So I would argue that actually agriculture should be across all of the negotiation.
This year's climate summit was a deadline for countries to submit their next round of national plans to bring down their carbon emissions. One criticism I've seen is that these plans have not sufficiently addressed agricultural emissions specifically. Has there been any movement on that front?
So when it comes to agriculture, almost 100% of NDCs mention agriculture.
NDCs are nationally determined contributions, the shorthand for those plans.
Exactly so. We were in the midst of the COP acronym madness.
So it's alphabet soup.
So these national climate plans, almost 100% mention agriculture and food systems in terms of how they're being impacted and in terms of some of the opportunities. But what we're seeing is not enough of them translated into tangible interventions for adaptation or for mitigation. And I think that's where part of the ambition gap lies. I mean, in the latest, these climate plans, amongst the top 15 agri-food emitters, only 8% of the emission reductions pledged for agri-food systems are supported by actual concrete mitigation measures.
There's been reporting that there are more agriculture industry lobbyists at this year's climate summit than usual. Has that changed the conversation around this topic?
I'm not sure. It's hard to tell. These are big events, big meetings. I think what we see is an increased visibility of agriculture and food systems, especially in what's called the sort of the presidency's action agenda. At a COP like this, you have, of course, the core negotiations, and you see the negotiated text that comes out, the Paris Agreement being the pinnacle of that. But parallel to the official process is the presidency's action agenda. And what we've seen over the past 4 or 5 years is an increased focus on agriculture and food systems. And we've seen that very much here as well. The COP30 presidency of Brazil has launched some fundamental initiatives to do with climate and agriculture. For example, an initiative called Raiz about restoration of degraded land. You've seen about the Tropical Forest Forever Facility, about basically finding a way to pay for standing forests. So yes, there are many, many players.
And I'll just note that that presidency track is not legally binding. There are no repercussions if people make promises they don't deliver on, unlike the Paris Agreement, which does have parts that are legally binding.
Exactly so. And that's why the action agenda is so important. I mean, we've seen to get to where we need to go, we need systems change. And that's a big ask. And to be able to get there, you need everybody, right? You need public, private, you need the partnerships, you need governments to lead, you need businesses to come in right behind.
Kaveh, the final hours of the negotiations are happening right now. How do things look there?
I'm very, very encouraged by the outcomes of basically trying to get into implementation. We're seeing real movement there. I'm less encouraged by what we see in the negotiation text. Not much reference to the central role of agriculture and food systems in being able to help us adapt to a changing climate and, of course, mitigate our emissions.
Kaveh Zahidi is the director of climate at the UN's Food and Agriculture Organization. The Chinese military is rapidly expanding its nuclear forces. According to a new congressional report, China has been building dozens of new missile silos and increased its stockpile of nuclear warheads by 20% in just the last year. The U.S. and Russia still have more atomic bombs than the rest of the world by far, but China's nuclear advances are changing the way arms control could work in the future. The World's Matthew Bell reports.
The prospect of a nuclear-armed China was so alarming to President John F. Kennedy that he asked the Pentagon to put together plans for a preventive U.S. military strike. That sort of attack never happened, and in 1964, the People's Republic of China joined the global family of nuclear weapon states.
This
The narrator in this Chinese propaganda film about the nuclear test says, "The speed of this great leap forward proves that the Chinese people, armed with Mao Zedong's ideology, dared to take a path that no one had walked before." At the time, some U.S. officials thought China getting the bomb was a good thing because it would be seen as a threat to America's number one enemy, the Soviet Union. This thinking turned out to be correct. In 1969, a border clash erupted and the two former allies almost went to war. China aimed its nuclear arsenal at targets inside the Soviet Union. Through much of the Cold War, Beijing saw the United States as an ally, and it viewed the Soviets as a bitter enemy.
In China, you know, they believe today's comrade may be tomorrow's enemy.
Today's comrade is tomorrow's enemy, says Hui Zhang. He's a professor at Harvard University's Kennedy School of Government and the author of a new book called The Untold Story of China's Nuclear Weapon Development and Testing. Zhang says China changed its thinking in the late 1990s and early 2000s as the Bush administration invested in a missile defense project. But the real turning point, Zhang says, came in 2012 with Xi Jinping.
After Xi Jinping entered the power, he emphasized China's nuclear deterrent with the U.S. So now they take U.S. as a major security threat.
American intelligence agencies say China now has around 600 nuclear warheads, and it's on track to have more than 1,000 by 2030. Hui Zhang says his research shows that China's modern nuclear warheads are more advanced than experts realized. Previously, the smallest warhead in China's arsenal was thought to be about 500 kilograms.
But in fact, Chinese modern nuclear warhead, they have two. One is 200, another is 100 kilograms. Half or one quarter what we believed before.
Smaller, miniaturized nuclear warheads are more dangerous because multiple bombs can be put onto a single missile and aimed at multiple targets. Still, China's nuclear stockpile is a fraction the size of the U.S. and Russian ones. Between them, they've got about 8,000 nuclear warheads. And here's why the Chinese government says it won't take part in arms control talks. Beijing says that Washington would need to reduce its nuclear arsenal to a similar level as China, or allow China to expand its numbers of weapons substantially. Only then would China agree to start talking about reducing nuclear stockpiles.
We are in the new nuclear arms race.
Serhii Plokhii is the author of another new book, The Nuclear Age, an epic race for arms, power, and survival.
The most probably dangerous feature of this new nuclear arms race is that there are not two front runners. There are three, and that changes the dynamic.
Think of it this way, Plokhii says.
There are more drivers on the nuclear highway, and there are much fewer traffic lights.
And there's a lot of uncertainty around questions like, if China attacks Taiwan, will the U.S. intervene? And what if Russia continues to challenge NATO?
The only way to deal with the uncertainty is to have a nuclear weapon in your pocket. Countries like South Korea, the countries like Japan, they're certainly financially, technologically more than capable of developing nuclear weapons within a short period of time. And pressure on them to do that is growing with every passing day.
There's nothing good about the proliferation of nuclear weapons, Plokhii says, but overreacting is another danger. Just imagine if Kennedy had ordered a military strike against China in the early 1960s. We're going to have to live with nuclear weapons, Plokhii says. The question is, how do we manage them collectively? But the worst approach of all is a chaotic global arms race. In that scenario, there are no winners, Serhii Plokhii says. And everyone loses. For the world, I'm Matthew Bell.
This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. It is college application season for students in the U.S., a stressful time for many families. That stress can be compounded for immigrant families, that includes Asian American families, where education is often seen as the key to social and economic mobility. Heidi Shin reports on a novel nationwide program aimed at countering all the pressure on teens. And just a heads up, this story begins with a mention of suicide. Listen with care.
Teresa Sue had a sister who was suicidal in high school.
My teen sister had turned to me and just said she wanted to kill herself. Basically, like, I can't do this anymore. Like, I don't want to be here.
Sue is now a psychologist in New York and the founder of the nonprofit Speak. She knows the statistics. 3 in 10 Asian American youth have planned or attempted suicide. Many have anxiety, and as a cultural group, they tend to delay seeking help until symptoms become a crisis.
There's also a desire not to burden others. That's even felt among the second generation. That's actually passed down to our youth as well.
That's Michelle Garcia, Filipina-American, and the founder of the nonprofit Thriving Asians. And she says that most teens aren't likely to get help from a therapist or a clinician, but there's a good chance they'll turn to their peers.
Asian Americans are more likely to get support from a friend, a family member, a spiritual leader, someone that they know.
That's why she and Dr. Sue have started the Young Visionaries program, to help Asian American high school students to become watchguards for mental health needs in their communities.
Even if you're not an immigrant yourself, if you're a kid of immigrants.
It starts with a series of trainings. They're kind of like an immigrant family psychology 101, which explains why some Asian immigrant parents are the way they are.
You're dealing with something called acculturation stress.
Cultural clashes that cause stress, like the expectation to be quiet with elders at home.
Don't make waves.
While voicing your opinions with teachers at school.
You step up, speak up, be a leader. And so that's really hard to navigate two different worlds at the same time.
They also explain why education is so valued in the community. For much of the 20th century, immigrating to the U.S. was a means of escaping war and poverty. But due to highly restrictive immigration policies, you often needed an elite education to be granted a visa to the U.S. So there's a lot of anxiety around college admissions for some Asian Americans. Sue said this made sense in the context of the Asian education system.
In Asia, every single point matters. 100%, 99.9%. Every single student is ranked. And that ranking contributes to where you end up going to college and how successful you are.
Then the fear of not having enough persists, even after immigrating. And in the next generation in America, this still translates to education and jobs.
It almost ends up being a scarcity mentality in regards to opportunity. This fear of, if I don't take these opportunities, I'm not honoring my elders, I'm missing out on something, and you're a perceived failure from there.
Sue and Garcia try to help young people with flexible thinking.
You know, if you don't get into Harvard, does that actually mean you're not going to be successful? And you and I know the answer is no.
Teens also learn about their own limitations as peers, when to offer friends advice, and when to steer them to get professional help. And they learn to see the quieter signs when someone is struggling. Taking what they've learned from the training, the teens then go on to be ambassadors, launching their own ideas to improve teen mental health. Youth leader Ryan Lee hosts a teen podcast with his friend Max Wang, which has tens of thousands of views.
Hi, everybody. Welcome back to another episode of OCA Youth Podcasting.
They talk about things like peer pressure and assumptions.
They assume that their friends are getting hundreds on their math exams, and they have that indirect pressure to perform as well as they imagine their peers to be performing.
When in fact, not all Asian Americans fit the model minority myth. In Philadelphia, youth leader Caleb Chung is building a physical wellness space in Chinatown.
But the idea is also to not only provide an educational space, but also provide a space of relief.
He says that meeting in person helps to counter negative self-talk and rumination, and the comparisons being made on social media. As for the pressure coming from parents, he says it's not all a bad thing. It can be motivating.
But what they get wrong is the amount of pressure and the support that's needed.
In some ways, that's exactly what this program does. Some of the high-performing college-bound Asian Americans who sign up to help others, they're the ones at risk for anxiety too. But they might choose leadership training over therapy. So Thriving Asians founder Michelle Garcia says it can be a stealth mental health program for the young leaders themselves. She says that in their trainings,
We always start off with some kind of wellness practice that they can teach to their peers and their community members. They're all building skills in self-compassion, self-advocacy, self-care practices.
In other words, while they're learning strategies to support their friends, something else is happening too. They're taking better care of themselves. For The World, I'm Heidi Shin.
Music has the power to bring people together. A good example, a band from Ghana called Fra. Fra means mix in the Ghanaian Akha language, and it is precisely what the band is all about, a combination of music styles and influences ranging from old school Ghanaian pop to disco. Here's one of the band members from Fra to explain.
My name is Mano Salom Donyo. I'm the guitar player. We are from the band Fra, from Accra, Ghana. Primarily, our music is about having fun. We are actually hoping that when people listen to our music, we are spreading messages of love, of unity, and our fervent hope is that people will listen to these songs and it will touch their hearts some way, somehow, and they'll forget about all these differences they have and come together as one and just enjoy music, enjoy good music. We have a couple of singles of the album, 30 Billion, which is like a disco funk song, very groovy and very danceable, of our upcoming project, which is called Chalawate. Chalawate is a catchphrase which you find in Ghana. It basically means friend, let's go, or all in all, let's go. So we are on a journey and we started out and we are accelerating towards a particular goal. And when you look at the songs on the album, we chronicle a lot of everyday issues which most of us have experienced, from heartbreak to friendship to love, all in all, toying with your own emotions. And so we are taking the listeners on a ride, a roller coaster ride, so to speak. And we are asking them to come along with us on this journey and stay gripped to us. So that's why the album is called Chale Wote. So friend, come and let's go. Keep the style, don't change the vibe. Life goes around just like a merry-go-round. Never stress, smile and take a meeting.
That's Emmanuel Selam Donor of the band Fra from Accra, Ghana. He spoke to us back in 2023. Fra's single, Smile, takes us to the break. You're listening to The World. This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. When Sanna Marin became Finland's prime minister in 2019, she was the world's youngest elected national leader. For 4 years, Marin led her country through the COVID-19 pandemic and into the NATO military alliance after Russia invaded Ukraine. Her new memoir is called Hope in Action. It explores how she navigated these challenging times and the consequences of being a millennial living, in her own words, like someone my age. She recalls that when she became prime minister, she didn't feel fully ready.
It wasn't an easy choice. I had to step in a situation where we had a governmental crisis and the previous prime minister had to resign. And at that time, I had just under a two-year-old daughter at home. And of course, it took some consideration, should I seek that position or not, as the first vice chair of my party and a serving minister then. But then I got that positive feedback from my family and my close ones that said to me, of course, Sanna, you should run for that seat and office. You would do a good job. But I didn't actually feel ready. Mm-hmm. I was terrified of taking that position. And I asked those that were close to me at that night when I got elected, do I really have to do this now? So I couldn't say that I was fully ready and I felt fully confident. But I've also later learned that actually those moments when you don't feel ready and you don't feel maybe most prepared are the most important moments, because those are also the moments when you can learn. And then you can also find out that maybe you can do the things that you were maybe a bit scared of.
Not long after you took office, the COVID pandemic started. Finland had some of the lowest COVID rates in Europe during your time in office. You write that trust played a role in that. How so?
Trust, the deep trust that Finland has embedded within our society, played actually an extremely important role. We have that welfare model in Finland, Nordic welfare model, that enables everybody to pursue their dreams, have equal opportunities when it comes to education, to work, in society in general. And that kind of society also builds trust, because when you meet those hard situations in your own life, you can trust and count the togetherness and the society will carry you through those hard moments. So we have this deep trust within our society. And especially in the moments of crisis, it is extremely important that citizens and people can trust the institutions, us politicians, the government, but also the medical authorities, other institutions. So when we had to take extremely hard, restrictive measures on place, and many of those measures were actually volunteer-based because we didn't have all the legislation on place when COVID started, people listened, they trusted that we had their best interests on mind, and they participated from the voluntary basis. And that's why we were also able to keep our infection rates so low and the death rates so low. So I would say the deep trust that we have within our society played an extremely important role.
Hmm. Russia invaded Ukraine while you were prime minister too, adding to the busyness of your tenure. Finland shares an 800-mile border with Russia, and it was not part of NATO at the time. It joined under your leadership. Can you talk about what the substantive difference for Finland's security is now, today, 2025, because it is a NATO member?
Well, of course, it was an extremely difficult situation when Russia started the full-scale invasion to Ukraine. And it also meant for Finland to have that discussion within our country, is the policy of being military non-aligned coming to an end, and should we seek a membership in NATO? And it was a very volatile moment because Europe was in active war and there were a lot of fears and worries also at that time. But it was at the same time very clear that we will seek membership. Finland has always invested heavily in our own defense capabilities because we have very difficult history with Russia. We have been under Russian rule, and after becoming independent, we have had to fight wars with Soviet Union. We have maintained our independence, but we have lost land and lives, and it have been extremely difficult period of our history. So we know what kind of aggressive neighbor we have. And we have invested heavily in our own defense capabilities, unlike many European countries. And seeking membership in NATO was, of course, ensuring that we wouldn't be alone in a situation if Russia would also pose that kind of threat towards Finland than it was posing to Ukraine. We have an aggressive neighbor and we have no illusion what it is capable of.
And so is Finland safer today because it is a member of NATO than it would have been otherwise, especially given the provocations that Russia is sending across the border into many European countries?
I would say that Finland is now more safe because we are part of the alliance. We already were a very close ally to NATO and we had deepened our cooperation and we were fully in line also with all the NATO capabilities before we applied the membership. But of course, we are now more safe together with the alliance. And I only hope that actually in the future, we can also see Ukraine part of NATO, because we have to understand that even though they are now in the midst of war, it is the only country in Europe that have that modern warfare experience. And they have the strongest army now in Europe. And we need the lessons learned from Ukraine. And we need Ukraine also as a security provider for all of Europe, because they are strong and they are sowing strength that is also unprecedented in our times.
Since leaving office in your post as prime minister, you've been working on efforts to support Ukraine. Why does Ukraine matter for the rest of Europe, especially right now when the U.S. is maybe not seen as such a reliable partner?
Ukraine is part of Europe, and Ukraine's future is part of Europe. And Europe is very reliant also of the future of Ukraine. So our futures and our destinies are linked. And I would say that one of the biggest mistakes that we as international community made was made 2014 when Russia attacked Ukraine and annexed Crimea. And the international response was so weak, and Russia took full advantage of that weakness. And now we shouldn't make the same mistake to be seen as weak, because there are authoritarian countries and leaders watching the actions of the democratic world. And if we don't show strength and determination, we will find it ahead of us.
Sana, I want to turn to something else you write about in your book, which is also something that our listeners here in the U.S. may remember, which is when you ended up in the news because of a video of you dancing with friends at a party. There was some criticism and also some support from high-profile women around the world. And you write in your book that it was important for you to be able to be yourself and not change to fit some stereotype of a prime minister. Why was that so important to you, even though it did draw criticism?
Well, of course, most of the time during my government was the handling the big crises, first global pandemic, the war in Ukraine, our NATO process, and just the everyday life of a coalition government, the endless negotiations and domestic politics and European politics that I had to handle as a prime minister. But there were also those moments that felt personally to me frustrating and also out of proportion. So my book has a whole chapter about my scandals.
Right. Whole list of them.
Yeah, whole list of them. Not political by nature. So not scandals about misuse of power or money or corruption or any serious to do with the work itself, but they are on the moralistic side. And of course, the most famous scandal is the dancing scandal, where I had a free night during my summer holiday at a friend's apartment. And we sang and we danced, and this was filmed. And then the footage leaked to the press, and there was this moral panic. How can I spend this kind of free time with my friends as a prime minister? Is that appropriate? And for me, it was very important to tell, quite frankly, that this is me. The voters can decide whether they appreciate me and my actions or not. But I didn't apologize of me dancing or singing, because there was nothing wrong with that. And I don't want to see women in general to be marginalized only to be a certain part of themselves. I think women are entitled to be fully themselves, 100% of themselves, whether they are in different professions or whether they are prime ministers or leaders. So we can be strong, capable, hard at our job, very tough at our job. And at the same time, we can be mothers and sisters and good friends, and we can have free time and we can be silly and also dance and sing. And it doesn't make us at all uncredible in our jobs.
Whether it's right or not, though, your personal life, like going out dancing, did bring this scrutiny. And you wrote of your decision to exit politics, "I was tired of being torn down by the press for years." So I'm wondering, would you behave any differently if you went back and did it all again?
I wouldn't behave differently, but I understand that the world is still very different for men and for women, and women face moral standards that actually nobody can reach. And that's why it's also so important to support women. The press scrutiny was only one part why I decided to leave politics. Actually, the much bigger reason was more personal, because as I said, I had a under 2-year-old child at home when I started as a prime minister. And I was working so much for the 4 years in office that I'm really grateful that I was able to serve my country. But still, it meant missing out a lot from my daughter's childhood. Now she's 7, just started school. And I decided 2023 that I don't want to miss out her entire childhood. So it was a personal decision. Also, even though I must say and admit that the interest that the media had on my personal life felt intrusive many times.
You are only 40 years old. You have a long career ahead of you. How do you think about making that meaningful, especially when whatever you do, you will internally weigh against the impact you were able to make as prime minister?
I have always thought that life is a mystery. So I never made a 5-year or 10-year plans for my career or for myself. I still feel extremely passionate about the issues why I joined politics in the first place. Human rights, gender equality, equality in general, that everybody have opportunities in their lives, that we built our societies in a way that your background isn't the defining factor in your life, but you are able to educate yourself, and also tackling climate change, loss of biodiversity, the big crises that humanity is facing. So I'm still very passionate about these issues, but I'm also able to work with these issues in different ways. I have never said never to go back to politics. Life will show me where my path will take me. But I also appreciate life as a mystery that it is. So I'm taking one day at a time and try to make a difference in those small ways that I can.
Sanna Marin, thank you so much for this conversation.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much for having me.
Sanna Marin was Finland's prime minister from 2019 to 2023. Soccer is seen as the most popular sport in the world, with an estimated 3.5 billion fans across the globe. Of course, many people also play themselves on their local fields or pitches. There is another sport that is, let's say, soccer adjacent, that is also beloved and growing. The World's Bianca Hillier reports on the sport of futsal.
To the uninitiated, futsal is often quickly described as indoor soccer. That's not too far off the mark, but Lucas Dantas puts it a different way.
The best way to describe it is like a mix between soccer and basketball.
Dantas is a coach and technical director for Jinga Futsal, a club in New England. He says futsal is played indoors on a court that's a little bigger than a basketball court.
Just like basketball, 5v5, you play on a hard surface, you play with sneakers.
You still kick the ball around with your feet, like in soccer, but the ball is a bit different too, says Jamie Fahey, a journalist at The Guardian.
So it's slightly heavier, so it stays on the ground more, doesn't bounce as much. It's about 40% of the bounce of a regular soccer ball.
Fahey says there are also key differences in the rules. For example, in futsal, there are unlimited substitutions and none of that pesky offsides business. Plus, futsal goalies can only keep possession of the ball for 4 seconds.
So you have to get on with the game. It's quite a fast, frenetic sport, and there's lots of physical contact.
Futsal dates back nearly a century to the year 1930. A man named Juan Carlos Seriani created the game in Uruguay. But Fahey, who also wrote a book on the history of the sport, says futsal quickly spread to neighboring Brazil, which is where it really took off.
From Brazil in the 1960s, it moved into Europe, mainly Eastern Europe to start off with, then Spain and into parts of Asia.
FIFA, soccer's global governing body, took control of the game in 1989 and hosted the first men's futsal World Cup that same year. Brazil won the inaugural tournament and 5 of them since then, making them the most successful national team in the sport's history. Women have been playing the game since the late 20th century, and there are professional leagues in places like Brazil, Indonesia, Spain, and Italy. But those athletes have had to wait until now to get the first ever Women's Futsal World Cup. Kickoff for the inaugural tournament was just this morning in the Philippines.
Drift out to the right-hand side, coming back in again. Cues up the strike.
the host nation played Poland, with the Europeans winning handily, 6-0. There are 16 countries in the tournament, and a total of 224 players. With the sport being relatively similar to soccer, you may think the national team's rosters are full of soccer players. But in fact, less than 5% of the athletes have played in FIFA soccer tournaments before.
Not all the soccer players can play futsal, because they are different kind of games. If you try to implement your soccer technique on futsal, it might not work.
Diego Barrado is the head coach of the U.S. national women's futsal team. The U.S. didn't qualify for this World Cup. The team has only been around for about 2 years. They've won a couple of games, but are still ranked 76th in the world. Barrado, born and raised in Brazil, is at the tournament in the Philippines anyway.
I watched the games a little bit. We're going to see what we can improve, what the level of the competition is. And then from there, we're going to come back and we're going to have a meeting with the staff, with the federation as well, and see if we can improve our program. How can we work on that?
The U.S. Soccer Federation is currently building a massive new facility in Atlanta, Barrado says, and that'll give the women's futsal team a home base to prepare for the next World Cup in 4 years. For now, though, Brazil and Spain are two of the favorites to win the tournament, followed closely by Portugal and Italy. The inaugural FIFA Women's Futsal World Cup runs until December 1st. For The World, I'm Bianca Hillier.
Baghdad has been a center of culture and learning for centuries. A cafe in the heart of one of Baghdad's oldest neighborhoods has hosted writers, intellectuals, and artists for more than 100 years. It's at the end of a street of booksellers and was once a publishing house. But in addition to being a cultural hub, it's also been a target of extremists. Reporter Duri Buscarin takes us inside.
Omar Al-Kashali's life is woven into the fabric of Shahbandar Cafe. He owns the cafe and calls it Iraq's little house. Through an interpreter, Kashali tells me how, as a child, he and his brothers would stay here from morning until night while their father managed the place. The cafe is in a historic building that was originally a printing press. Was once owned by Iraqi politician Musa al-Shahbandar. The wooden benches are covered in red kilim material, like a 19th century coffee house. Framed photos line the walls. Kashali tells me he remembers how his father carefully chose each of the photographs. Visits of kings, famous writers, men who sang maqam, traditional poetic stories that are memorized and sung in a kind of narrative history. When Kashali's family took over ownership of the cafe in 1963, they decided to keep it as a place where time stands still. The menu never changes. Arabic coffee, black tea, or a sour tea made with dry black limes and a healthy spoonful of sugar. You can smoke shisha out of a tall hookah pipe, but you can't play backgammon, Kashali says.
Just no sound.
Kashali likes it quiet. He wants you to have a conversation here, meet a new friend. Cafe regulars remember certain rules from years long gone, how certain writers would have a specific bench where they would sit, and no one else could sit there. One of the regulars, Jamal Abdullah Al-Kassab, remembers coming here every day to drop off a packed lunch for his father, a barber who worked nearby. His friend, Ahmed Qasim Al-Amin, also comes often. And in those days, he says, younger men wouldn't sit in the cafe if their father or older brothers were there. It was a gesture of respect. These stories and memories are all part of the legacy that Kashali hopes to protect. There were temptations to change it or even sell the property, Kashali says. But my father resisted, and he insisted on keeping it as it always was. Shabandar Cafe has been here through it all, charting the history of Baghdad since 1917, the independence of Iraq from the British Mandate in 1932, the long reign of dictator Saddam Hussein, and the U.S. invasion in 2003. Iraqi journalist Awad Al-Tayyib first introduced me to Shabandar Cafe, and it's been a part of his life, too.
This cafe represents the history of Iraq, the suffering of Iraq.
In 2007, 4 years into the U.S. occupation, Al-Qaeda militants drove a car full of explosives to Shabandar Cafe. Altai was one of the first reporters on the scene.
Caused to the killing of 68 and wounded more than 150 persons, part of the place being destroyed.
Among the dead were owner Omar Al-Kashali's 4 brothers and a nephew. Kashali was the only son to survive. He and his father, Muhammad Al-Kashali, decided to repair the cafe and reopen. And Altai says the community supported them.
Me and my colleagues and my friends and many people decided to make a challenge against Al-Qaeda.
If Al-Qaeda wanted to stop people from reading with this symbolic attack, Altai wanted to fill Shabandar Cafe to show they couldn't be stopped.
And we succeed. Al-Qaeda's gone and the cafe remained.
Kashali's father printed large photographs of his sons and grandson who died in the bombing. He hung them on the wall and renamed Shabandar the Martyrs Cafe. Kashali remembers how his father would always say,
"I forgive, but not forget."
The following years were difficult. The U.S. occupation lasted until 2011, displacing millions and leaving the Iraqi economy in tatters. In 2016, at the height of the ISIS insurgency, Kashali was kidnapped and held for ransom in Baghdad.
It's mafia, just like mafia. They put me in the hall. They want to kill me.
But his family paid a $60,000 ransom, and he escaped to Turkey. Kashali returned to Iraq 3 years ago to take care of his father, who had become ill. His father, a longtime owner of the cafe, passed away in January at the age of
93.
My father represented the legacy of this place, Kashali said. The whole world knew him. He estimates that at his father's funeral, 10,000 people came to pay their respects. Today, when he comes to work, his family's portraits watch over him. There's a soul in this place, he says. I am sure that my brothers and my father are listening. For The World, I'm Derry Buscarin, Baghdad.
I'm going to send you off into the weekend on an uplifting note. That is a French horn blasting from the coldest place on Earth. Natalie Payne, a musician in New Zealand's Navy, uses it to practice in Antarctica. Here's a snippet from her warm-up. Payne grew up wanting to be a scientist in the Antarctic. She ended up studying music instead. But now she plays the French horn for New Zealand's Navy, which has a base in Antarctica, and she landed a coveted post there. Practicing in the cold is a bit complicated, though. She uses a plastic horn made for children. It is light, durable, low maintenance, and crucially not made of brass. If you have seen A Christmas Story, you know how important that is.
Are you kidding? Stick my tongue to that stupid pole, that's dumb.
That's cause you know it'll stick.
You're full of it. Oh, yeah?
Yeah!
So, yeah, no sticking to frozen metal with a plastic horn. In a video sent to us by the New Zealand Navy, Natalie Payne is in a sparse practice room playing Amazing Grace to a frozen sea. No penguins in sight, but I bet they'd like it too. The world. World is produced by GBH and PRX, broadcasting weekdays from the Nan and Bill Harris studio in Boston. Find us online anytime at theworld.org and find our original reporting on YouTube. We are at The World News GBH, all one word. Be sure to subscribe. I'm Carolyn Beeler. Have a fabulous weekend. We will see you back here on Monday.
The World is supported by the Carnegie Corporation of New York, working to reduce political polarization through philanthropic support for education, democracy, and peace. More information at carnegie.org. By the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. MacFound.org. And by FJC, a foundation of philanthropic funds serving the nonprofit sector with donor-advised funds, fiscal sponsorship, bridge lending, and more. FJC.org. The World's theme music is composed by Ned Porter. The World is a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. More information at theworld.org.